Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. I mentioned mail the other day, and I said I got a whole stack of it on my desk, and I don't make this stuff up. In fact, I decided it was time that we go through the mailbag, and that's what this is. So I don't think I've addressed any of these letters on the air before directly, although some of them possibly topic-wise. But so if you feel like writing to me and you want to do it the old-fashioned way, the address is in the credits at the end of the videos, and they've been there for a little while, so I have a P.O. box, which I often show up, and it's just jam-packed with stuff, which is pretty cool. So, got a letter here, typed. Hey, there's bonus points for typing. Mr. Leto, I have a question you might find interesting enough to answer. Do court reporters ever make mistakes in transcribing the verbal proceedings during a court case? I've had a court reporter make a mistake in a deposition, which is very, very similar. And I've mentioned this before, but I had a very, very important case where I asked the witness, my opposing witness, an extremely important question. The answer is either yes or no. And if they answered yes, I would win. If they answered no, we'd still fight about it. And on the record, I asked the question and it said yes. And I looked at him and said, oh, okay, we're done here. And we all went our way. And I ordered a copy of the transcript. I opened up the back page and it says question, answer, no. And I'm like, what? So I pull my own notes out, and I'd written down that the person said yes. And so I called the court reporter and said, you know, my records show the person said yes, and you wrote down that they said no. And the court reporter's like, oh my gosh. And she pulls out her notes and she listens, and she had a recording of it, an audio recording of it. And she's like, oh my gosh, you're right. You're right. And so she had to send me an amended page and then send copies to everybody else saying, by the way, that page had a mistake in it. And in 28 years of practice, that's the only time that's happened that I've known. Now, I haven't gone through every single transcript to see verbatim if every single word was correct. But like I said, the important stuff, we pretty much pay attention to. So in a situation like that, you hope there's a backup. But if there's not a backup, you might have a problem. I've also heard of situations where they've got a video system in a courtroom, and the video system is designed to pick up which camera or which microphone is getting the most audio and use that camera and then use that audio. And there have been occasions where people are talking over each other or someone said something that's unclear. You can imagine when I get wound up and I'm talking really fast that somebody might say, hey, I can hear what he's saying. I mean, there's a recording of it, but we don't know what it is. So that's another situation altogether. He then asked also, when the judge asks both parties to approach the bench, like the attorneys, or calls them into chambers, do these conversations become part of the record? And that's always going to be a situation that's going to be made very, very clear to the attorneys at the time. So if the judge calls the attorneys up to the bench and puts his hand over the microphone or tells the court reporter we're off the record, that will be off the record. However, and I've had people ask, they say, but what if you wanted it on the record? You can do that. So if the judge said something to you that was like crazy and you thought it was important, you could actually say, Your Honor, I need that to be on the record. And you could step back and put it on the record. Same thing back in chambers. But the thing you have to remember is that back in chambers, a lot of times people will be speaking less formally. And I've had a judge, I've seen a judge tell someone, by the way, your case is very, very weak. Now, if you wanted to get the judge to put that on the record out in open court, they're not going to do that. They're going to say, I was just making an observation to you that I thought might help you somehow get the case to settle or go away or work with your client or something like that. And, you know, I did a magic trick about a week ago where I showed how to make coins disappear. And there was a judge in Wayne County who famously would do card tricks. And he did it as a way to kind of break the ice. And I remember him actually telling us, calling the attorneys into his office, chambers, close the door, and pulls out a deck of cards. And he's like, you know, can you guys settle this case? And if we said no, he'd say, if I do a card trick and you can't explain it to me, how about then? The guy would start doing card tricks. But that was just his way of entertaining us. And we settled a lot of cases in front of that guy. I liked him a lot. So that is some questions raised by Art out of Texas. So thank you, Art, for passing that along. I got a letter and I feel bad I didn't answer this sooner. But Tom sent me a note and said, you know, Steve, I love your videos. I'm a retired author and traveler, and I travel throughout the United States during the summertime. I love the American way of life, and in particular, the Constitution. I supplement my small income by writing books and selling things like books and flags and t-shirts and so on. But he goes, I've noticed that various states have different rules and restrictions stopping me from selling my stuff. Where in some places you can work on one side of a street, but not the other, or in this town, but not that town. He said, I was even once arrested for selling teddy bears on Valentine's Day. It seems to me that you should be able to come to America with $1 million, buy anything you want, but then how odd is it that you are not allowed to sell something? So, you know, this is one of those things that I tend to agree that on a, you know, on a typical situation, you know, if I want to set up a lemonade stand at the end of my driveway, whether I'm an 8-year-old child or a 57-year-old attorney, I should be allowed to do that all day long. Now, if you want to set up a business downtown and, like, say, sell food, you're going to have to probably comply with some food regulations for the local, you know, health board to make sure you're not selling poisonous food. But the idea that you're at the side of the road selling teddy bears on Valentine's Day, unless you're doing it in the parking lot of a Hallmark store and taking their business away or something like that, it seems to me that they shouldn't do anything about that. But the problem, of course, is, you know, there's going to be a lot of ordinances on the books, and it depends on if you get a police officer who wants to enforce that or not. And I just noticed that this business card is attached to this letter with what appears to be a sewing needle. But so he did end it by saying, I'd be grateful if you would answer these questions for me. I've been to your state, by the way, a beautiful country, upper and lower peninsulas, but the worst potholes in the roads I've ever seen. You are preaching to the choir, my friend. By the way, he apparently has got a book called Run Toward the Blazing Sun, which tells about a trip he had that apparently was a nightmare in Turkey. Run Toward the Blazing Sun. I'll check that out. But, you know, when Tom says that Michigan's got the worst potholes, not only do we have the worst potholes, we've got potholes in Michigan that dwarf anything that you have in your state. I don't care where, I don't care what country you're in. You could be in a country that hasn't developed roads yet, and your roads are better than ours. In Michigan, we've got potholes that swallow cars and car parts and just dismantle cars. And I actually have taken photographs of some potholes. If I can find them, I'll post them. But the funny thing is that I've traveled in and out of the state from what's called Detroit Metro Airport. And it's an airport west of Detroit, about 45 minutes, in a place called Romulus. And the airport, for some odd reason, is in a section of the state where not only do we have bad potholes, but among the worst in, again, the nation. So that people who come to Michigan and fly into Detroit Metro Airport, the busiest airport in Michigan, get off the plane, get to the car rental place, and there's only two ways to get in the freeway. Both of them, you're running a gauntlet of potholes where you're actually going to be concerned that you may have damaged your rental car before you got on the freeway. And I used to complain to everyone I know, why don't they at least fix the potholes around the airport? Now, it's been a little while since I've been out there, maybe a year or so. But I'm telling you right now, the one place you shouldn't have potholes is at the airport. Because people who come in to visit, it's the first thing they encounter once they get off the plane. Makes them wish that they just kept flying. Hey, Steve, I've been watching your videos for a few months. Today I watched a video about your paper route and your car. Both stories brought back a lot of memories. My paper route was 7 miles long. Oh, my God. It's an afternoon paper, and, of course, in Northern California. I had a much easier time in the winter, but even at $1.75 a month, I had customers that didn't have change. Oh, my God. He said, I have to come back several times to collect. It was with that money I made on the route that I bought the 1963 Buick LeSabre convertible that I owned for the next 47 years. Oh, my. It was destroyed along with everything else that I owned by the Tubbs Fire of 2017. That's sad. It was equipped with a bulletproof 401 nailhead engine and the last and best of the Dynaflow automatics. Shortly after I bought the car, I too found a four-barrel carburetor and manifold. Unlike you, I did everything a kid could do to break the car and never managed to do more than pay stiff traffic fines. Hey, it's the cost of growing up. I'm pretty sure our local courthouse has a wing I funded and should be named after me. I enjoy your videos. Thanks, Jeff. And by the way, Jeff has two dogs, Fred and Sammy. So hey, Fred. Hey, Sammy. How you doing? For those of you who always give me a shout out to Milo and Wolfie. By the way, someone sent me a photograph of an actual tree someplace out west. And I'll put the picture right there. Okay. I also got, I forgot if I mentioned this or not. This is pretty cool, but I got a radiogram. It says American Radio Relay League at the top, and it's number one, precedence routine. I don't know what a lot of this means, but it goes station of origin, KD4ERC. Place of origin, London, Kentucky. Time filed, 1830. And it says, to Steve Leto, and it's got my address on it. And it says, the message was received at KD4ERC, and it gives a phone number, and it says, name, Daryl. And it's a telegram. It says, Steve, you have just received your first telegram. Stop. From an amateur radio operator. Stop. Sincerely, Daryl W. Peters, KD4ERC. Hope all is well. And this is an actual radiogram. And the funny thing is that I've jokingly said about, you know, telegrams, because telegrams are mentioned in that one statute. And they said, if you want to notify them, you can either write them a letter or mail them, send them a telegram. And people said, what's up with the telegrams? So Daryl's pointing out that, Steve, you enclosed find a radiogram, which is a ham radio version of a telegram. He says, I'm taking some shortcuts here, but you'll appreciate this because technically speaking, he thinks this might still be a telegram. But of course, amateur radio is regulated, and this means that you can't be using it for business purposes, but it is used to send health and welfare messages or in times of distress, messages concerning hospital patients or emergency service needs. But he says this does, in fact, become a conversation piece, and it is. It is. And by the way, I know some ham radio operators. My brother Ken, the one who got me the discount on my Ford, had a ham set up at our house. And I've also known other guys who, old school, Morse code. So, you know, that's cool. A couple other things, depending on how much time we've got here. Dear Mr. Steve Leto. I love the formality of the paper letters too. The question is, how likely is it that various internet websites might ban people like you and Scotty Kilmer because you criticize large corporations? And, you know, it's an interesting point. I've had people ask me about that, and they say, and this is from Jerry. You know, I've had people ask me about that, and they say, Steve, you do talk about car companies or insurance companies or, you know, different organizations that you think might be ripping people off. I mean, is that kind of a problem? And I've mentioned before that, you know, this channel's monetized, and I've had one or two videos of mine that got demonetized for whatever reason, but I'm not that worried about it. I just do what I do. And if it's monetized, great. If it gets demonetized, okay, I'll pay attention to figure out if I can see why it got demonetized, but I'm not going to like change, you know, how I talk about this stuff. I'm not going to say, oh, suddenly I like this company. I love what these guys are doing all of a sudden. You know, it's not going to change how I present this stuff, but, I'm not that worried about it only because, you know, I can tell you right now, I've met people who work very, very high up at the car companies that I sue. And I've told them what I do for a living, and they're like, it doesn't bother them because they understand it's a part of the cost of doing business. If you build a million of something, they're not all going to be perfect. And the bad ones that get through are lemons. And so they'd rather have someone like me who's reasonable, deal with them and straighten it out, than an unreasonable attorney who might say, buy the vehicle back and pay me $1 million in attorney fees. So I'm not that worried about it, but I appreciate the concern. But same gentleman says, I used to be a Lansing State Journal paperboy, so I know what you're talking about concerning the life of a paperboy. And of course, Lansing State Journal is one of the newspapers here in Michigan, of course, out of Lansing. And I wonder if they even have home delivery anymore, because I think they're one of the smaller papers that may have gone by the wayside. And then a couple more here really quickly. Ed wrote me and said, hey, Steve, I really enjoy your shows, especially about paper routes and the one about your Charger and Gremlin. I mentioned that the Gremlin was the first car I had to drive to school and back. My parents owned it. But then I wound up with a 69 Dodge Charger. And he says, I also had a paper route at 4 a.m. in Memphis, Tennessee. I had to get up around 5, I think, but on really, really bad days, I might even get up a little earlier than that. He said, I had the same experience with the collections. Everyone, delivering the papers is the easy part. Getting these people to pay for the paper, that can be hard. Strangely enough, he says, I also had a 1974 Dodge Charger and a 1973 Gremlin, which was a piece of junk. Oh, it looked like a high top tennis shoe. The Charger was great. Brown with the white top with the studio windows for the back seat. You know, and I know what he's talking about. It's got a little window with a think back on the, I guess that'd be the B pillar. Anyways, I really enjoy your shows, and the ones about attorney subjects are very enlightening, since that's one subject I know nothing about. Keep up the good work. It's fun to watch. And he is spent time in the Air Force and the Air National Guard. So thank you for your service, and thank you for your letter. And then finally, Dan wrote me a note and said, hey, Steve, let's say I'm pulled over by the police and they end up being killed by me. It's a hypothetical, I hope. I go on about my business and go home. Eventually, I get arrested, and then I get put on trial. The question is, could we argue that I'm charged with murder and I can prove that I was defending myself against the civil asset forfeiture? Would you be able to make that argument and possibly say that the judges or the court system itself is somehow at fault here? And, you know, it's interesting, and he's joking, and he points out this isn't, in fact, a hypothetical. But I get asked that question a lot, but what's interesting about that question, and, you know, we talk about civil asset forfeiture and how crazy it is, the idea that the police can pull you over, not arrest you, not charge you the crime, just take your money and go, you want your money back, sue us. And people are like, what? Because it's so un-American, it's obviously unconstitutional. But the U.S. Supreme Court in its past has said, well, no, it's okay because of, and they find some real weird technical loopholes as to why that's okay. And most people can't wrap their heads around it for good reason, okay? There's a reason why that is offensive to you logically and why it's offensive to me logically, okay? And that is because it's wrong. It's theft. The police departments steal money from law-abiding citizens. And they're incentivized to do it because they get to keep the money. So the reason that it raises questions like this, it's kind of, I admit, an extreme question. But the real point of this is, yes, it's wrong. It needs to change. Timms versus Indiana, the case I talked about previously, addresses this somewhat, but not completely. The Supreme Court needs to come out and just say, you know something, you can't steal from U.S. citizens. And if you want to make an argument that you're entitled to what you took from them, you got to get it around the Fourth Amendment. And there's problems doing that when you just stole it from somebody who didn't break the law and you can't even come up with a reason as to why you think you get to keep the stuff. So that's that. But Dan, thanks for the question. It's thought provoking. And as always, like I said before, I get stacks of mail. It piles up on my desk, but I love it. Email piles up in an email folder. It's not quite the same. There's something tactile about being able to actually open the envelopes up and read them and realize I am holding a piece of paper and reading a piece of paper that was in someone else's hands earlier, and they put the words on it with their own hands or with their own equipment. So again, the address is in the credits. Contact me anytime with anything you want to say. Otherwise, questions or comments, put them below. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.